Bryn will someday write the definitive handbook on becoming a successful and even wealthy Martian. Emily Lakdawalla shakes things up on the moon in her Q&A segment, and Bruce Betts will join me for our usual What's Up look at the night sky, including a new space trivia contest with a special prize for one of you. So we'll head for the red planet right after Bill Nye shares some thoughts about heading back to the moon.
Hey, Bill Nye, the planetary guy here, Vice President of the Planetary Society. This week, as you may know, the Augustine Commission is going to testify in front of Congress about their findings about what NASA should be doing with its billions of dollars. Well, I'm sure that'll be lovely. Meanwhile, NASA has a couple of spacecraft orbiting the moon. Among other things, they're going to crash L-Cross into a crater, hoping to see water. And the reason they're looking for water, of course, it is of great scientific interest. The surface of the moon is a bit of a time capsule storing everything that's hit it over the last 1,000 centuries or so. But what people are hoping for is they can find water on the moon, and that'll be a reason to go back to the moon with people from the U.S. Yes, that really won't be a reason to go back to the moon. People are not going to go there and start drinking moon water. This is not going to happen. Meanwhile, by the way, speaking of the moon, the Indian Space Research Organization, Chandrayaan spacecraft, observed the Apollo 15 landing site. Not bad. So for you hoaxers out there, you know, I was on Fox News a few weeks ago. For you hoaxers, there's another picture of Apollo spacecraft on the lunar surface. There is no reason for the United States to go back to the moon with people. Let the other countries that need to do it for their national pride, China and India, perhaps Japan, get that done. Meanwhile, we've got to go exploring new cool places because we've got to look for other places that might have signs of life because that will change life here on Earth. Now, you know, I may have said this before. Here's hoping that the United States takes a leadership role instead of a followership role and we go on to, dare I say it, change the world. Now, for the rest of you who live in other countries and are good members of the Planetary Society, thanks for your support. We will get through this. I gotta fly. Bill Nye, the Planetary Guy.
We're going to try something this week that has never before been attempted. By special arrangement with the Lawrence Livermore Lab, we have opened up a wormhole, or space-time rift, that will allow us to talk with one of Mars's most successful citizens. This Robert Zubrin of the 22nd century has written what may be the best, or now that I think of it, the only guidebook to surviving and thriving on that nearby world. Luckily, it has been transmitted back through the rift to us and has been published by Three Rivers Press. As you'll hear, this Martian actively distances himself from his 21st century namesake, even though the contemporary Robert Zubrin founded the Mars Society and co-created the Mars Direct Plan. I don't know how long we'll be able to maintain the rift, so we better get started. Robert, it is a special pleasure to speak to you across, nearly a couple of centuries and get a chance to talk to you about life on Mars, which you cover so much, a lot of practical information in this terrific book, How to Live on Mars, a trusty guidebook to surviving and thriving on the red planet. I don't know if you know that you've received some great reviews for the book back here in the early 21st century.
Well, yes, I've heard about that. I've been able to research them in the historical archives.
It's funny how that works. Listen, I know that you graduated from Robert Heinlein High in 2099 up there in the New Plymouth Colony. How do Martians feel about that 20th century author? Because really, your book reminds me very much of his approach to things.
Well, I have to take offense at that. That guy was a humorless astronautical engineer. It's true he made some technical contributions, but he didn't know squat about how to game the system.
Now, are you talking about Heinlein or your namesake, Robert Zubrin, from back in those days?
The guy who had the same name as me.
Oh, yeah, okay. But I'm assuming that Heinlein, since your high school is named after him, that he's somewhat in more of a position of honor?
Yes, Heinlein is held in great honor for his not only his foresight of a spacefaring civilization, but his belief in human freedom and human liberty, which we Martians all treasure greatly.
Yeah, that certainly is a constant theme throughout the book. But let's talk about some of the practical advice that you offer. Let's say that I see you still have cell phones or telephones there in the 22nd century. If you have to get that, we'll let you. But otherwise, I've got a question for you. Let's assume that I've just stepped off a private freighter in that new Plymouth colony on the Red Planet. And by the way, that already indicates that I've taken some of your advice, because I haven't used one of the NASA's nuclear electric ships or those old cyclers, you call them. But now that I've set foot on Ares Firma, what are the most important things for me to know as I set out to make my fortune?
Well, you need to know how to choose your gear, how to choose your wheels. You need to know how to choose your home. You need to know how to get a job that won't kill you. A lot of the open jobs here will. That's why they're open. And then you need to know how to make some serious money.
Let me just grab one of those for a moment. I guess there are a couple of major choices in 22nd century technology spacesuits. And you really recommend the one that goes all the way back to our era.
Yes, that's true. There's a couple of things you guys got right. Yeah, there's two kinds of spacesuits you can get. You can get the old-style pneumatic spacesuits, inflatable spacesuits, same kind that were worn way back in the Apollo period in the 20th century. Or you can wear these new-style skin suits, elastic suits that fit your body like a second skin. Those can look very stylish if you have the right figure. But for most people, they can be quite embarrassing. And that's why I recommend going with a classic.
All right. Well, we've noted that. It really is amazing the range of advice that that you offer. Everything from, well, you've named a lot of them, but even making your own food, making your own oxygen, of course. I find it amazing that so many settlers up there, frontiers people, find it useful to do everything from, yeah, making their own air to making their own plastics. And is that really practical?
Well, it's very useful. Now, you don't really have to make all these things, but you have to be able to, because otherwise the people who are willing to supply them to you will exploit your dependence on them and charge you an arm and a leg. So some of these things you certainly do want to make yourself, like your own oxygen. That can be easily done through the techniques explained in this book. We can strip oxygen out of the carbon dioxide Martian atmosphere. Others of them, making plastics, making metals, you may want to have someone in your local settlement do that, but you don't want to be dependent on either the Mars Authority or the criminal underground to supply you with them, because either one will be delighted to take advantage of your dependence.
Actually, as you describe them, there doesn't seem to be much difference between the Mars Authority and the so-called sisterhoods. That's, I take it, the sort of extra-legal element you were talking about?
Yes, the sisterhoods. You know, if you think back to Earth, various immigrant groups at various times controlled certain aspects of the economy. For instance, at one point, Irish immigrants controlled crime in the United States, but then they moved on to the police force, leaving crime for a certain period of time to Italians, who then left it on to others. And, well, on Mars, women have taken over organized crime.
And I bet they're better at it than a lot of the predecessors were.
They do pretty good.
Listen, speaking of women, who is this Becky Sherman that so many of you Martians have put up statues to?
Well, Becky Sherman was a member of the first landing crew way back at the beginning of the 21st century. And she was the exobiologist on the mission, and by no means the most valuable member of the crew in terms of getting out of the various tight spots they got into. But she was the one who did discover life on Mars, and that's why she is famous on both Mars and Earth today. She really showed Martians today the way to celebrity, which is to make fantastical discoveries. Now, I do have a section in my book explaining how you can become famous, and a lot of people wonder about that because, you know, most of the great discoveries that could be made on Mars were either made by Sherman or the people that followed in the next few expeditions when the planet was fresh and, you know, there was amazing things to be discovered. So how can you make a discovery? I have quite a list of discoveries that are waiting to be made on Mars. I can list a few of them for you if you like.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to hear some of those. These are great opportunities.
Okay, so here's a list. Live nucleated cells of a type never before seen, fossil traces of extinct multicellular organisms, fossilized bones of extinct vertebrates, dinosaur footprints, recently deposited wildlife stool droppings, tracks left by vehicles of unknown types, rock inscriptions of unknown origin, technological artifacts of unexplainable provenance, ruins of structures clearly designed for non-humans, alien statues, remains of pre-spaceflight humans, for example, medieval knights, the Holy Grail, the One True Cross, angel skeletons, books or scrolls made of gold foil filled with writing that only you can decipher. Now, a lot of these discoveries take a certain amount of work to make, but there are qualified professionals in New Plymouth who can manufacture virtually any of them, and also good publicists that can publicize them, who are more than worth their fees.
We'll get more advice from 22nd century Martian Robert Zubrin in a minute. This is Planetary Radio.
I'm Robert Picardo. I traveled across the galaxy as the Doctor in Star Trek Voyager. Then I joined the Planetary Society to become part of the real adventure of space exploration. The Society fights for missions that unveil the secrets of the solar system. It searches for other intelligences in the universe, and it built the first solar sail. It also shares the wonder through this radio show, its website, and other exciting projects that reach around the globe. I'm proud to be part of this greatest of all voyages, and I hope you'll consider joining us.
You can learn more about the Planetary Society at our website, planetary.org/radio, or by calling 1-800-9-WORLDS. Planetary Radio listeners who aren't yet members can join and receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Our nearly 100,000 members receive the internationally acclaimed Planetary Report magazine. That's planetary.org/radio. The Planetary Society, exploring new worlds.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. We are privileged to be speaking with the author of How to Live on Mars, a trusty guidebook to surviving and thriving on the Red Planet. Its author, Robert Zubrin, who lives there in the 22nd century, says he's no relation, really, to the Robert Zubrin in our own time, who heads both the Mars Society and Pioneer Astronautics. That Robert Zubrin will be our guest next week. Just before the break, the future Robert Zubrin gave us his list of major discoveries still to be made on Mars, so long as you're willing to, well, be a bit creative in your approach. You know, you make hundreds of suggestions, this list among them, for ways to survive and thrive on Mars. Many of them appear to be, well, we said extra legal earlier, maybe supra legal. Are a lot of you and your fellow Martians a bit larcenous?
Larcenous, no, but we like to take advantage of the possibilities that an unexplored and undeveloped and untamed planet has to offer. I mean, look, you know, for instance, there's a tremendous amount of real estate here on Mars, and it's of unknown value today and perhaps not that valuable today, seeing as most of it's desert. But, you know, there are plans to terraform Mars so that someday some of this will be beachfront property. Now, it's unclear exactly where the beachfront is going to be or when it will be, but it's going to be somewhere sometime. And if a Martian owns some land and he wants to take an optimistic interpretation of its future value in order to sell it for an appropriate price to newer arrivals, well, you know, is that such a bad thing? I mean, after all, it could come true.
You say several times during the book what appears to be your motto, fortune favors the brave.
Yes, fortune favors the brave, without question. On Mars, or even Earth, I suppose, but certainly on Mars, where there are incredible opportunities, which in some cases involve a great risk, exploring in the outback. There are minerals that could be found there, perhaps, and in any way claimed where they have been found. It's a question of taking advantage of the possibilities.
Hmm. You're a principal in both Ares Botanicals and Ares Asteroidals, and you do encourage investments in those in our era still to come.
Well, that's only because these are such good investments that it would really be inappropriate for me not to allow other people to share
my
good fortune.
Hopelessly
yes.
Irresponsible of them. Can you tell us a little bit about that latter firm, Ares Asteroidals, and what your business plan is?
Oh, well, Ares Asteroidals is a business plan to mine the wealth of the asteroids. You know, the main belt asteroids, there are many of them that are quite rich in platinum group metals, platinum, gold, rhodium, all kinds of things that are of incredibly valuable on Earth. And the fact of the matter is that it is much easier to reach the asteroid belt from Mars than it is from Earth. So that compared to mining operations based on Earth, we hold an incredible advantage of position. And therefore, our operation should be incredibly profitable. So I strongly recommend this as a place to get in on the ground floor.
Let's look to your own future as we get near the end of our time here. I think our space-time rift is going to close up within a couple of minutes. There are some big projects going on up there on Mars, and really the biggest, you call it the biggest that humans have ever taken on, is terraforming. How's that going?
Well, the terraforming project has just begun. We're already seeing some results. And this, by the way, is the one project of the Mars Authority that virtually every Martian fully supports, because this is going to massively improve land values on Mars. The creation of an atmosphere, the creation of lakes, oceans, beachfront property, this is something we're all looking forward to. And they're doing it by actually a technique that was first proposed way back in the 20th century by a scientist named Chris McKay to produce fluorocarbon gases and just dump them into the atmosphere. They're very strong greenhouse gases. Back in those days on Earth, there were all kinds of people concerned about global warming. I don't know why. In any case, on Mars, we certainly favor global warming, and because this planet is too cold. And these gases are the most potent global warming gases you can possibly have, and they last a long time in the atmosphere. They're producing them. We've already warmed the planet up around 5 degrees. We've doubled the thickness of the atmosphere. This thing's moving forward, and all you have to do to make money off of it is just buy some land and wait for the beach to come to you.
Listen, there's so many more questions that I would love to ask you, but I've just gotten word from Lawrence Livermore that we're causing a brownout in San Francisco, holding this rift open. So I just got one more. You mentioned Chris McKay, and I'll be darned if in the photo of the founders of what I guess you're calling the Free Martian Republic, if I didn't see somebody, in fact, a lot of people there, who looked very much like they had an uncanny resemblance to 20th and 21st century Mars explorers and enthusiasts, the group that you call the Forerunners. Just a coincidence?
It has to be a coincidence. I can see no rational reason why the founders of the Free Martian Republic should look like people like Chris McKay and Carl Sagan and Ray Bradbury and Arthur Clarke and my namesake and so forth.
Well, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out of your day and using up a little bit of that hard-earned oxygen up there to tell us about life on Mars in the 22nd century. And I know a lot of us back here look forward to setting all of us on our way to that future that you've achieved.
Okay. Well, you are most welcome.
Robert Zubrin is a Martian. Born in 2071 in New Plymouth Colony up there on the Red Planet, he graduated from Heinlein High in 2099. He's now a famous, not to say infamous, Red Planet entrepreneur. And as he said, he is, shares his name with a certain fellow named Robert Zubrin back in our own time here in the early 21st century, who is a recipient of the National Space Society's Robert A. Heinlein Award, author of a lot of great books, including The Case for Mars, founded and headed the Mars Society, and is quite a booster of getting humans up to that red planet. We'll be back with Bruce Betts for this week's edition of What's Up, right after we hear from Emily.
Hi, I'm Emily Lakdawalla with Questions and Answers. A listener asked, I remember that the Apollo missions left seismometers on the surface of the moon. Did they detect any moonquakes? 5 of the Apollo missions deployed seismometers on the lunar surface. The Apollo 11 seismometer lasted only 3 weeks, but others operated until September of 1977. The seismometers successfully detected 3 different kinds of moon-shaking events. 2 were natural, internally generated moonquakes and externally caused meteoroid impacts. The seismometers also recorded ground shaking when mission controllers deliberately crashed leftover spacecraft into the lunar surface, including the third stages of Saturn V rockets and the used ascent stages of the landers. But what's the use of detecting ground motion on the moon? The shape and timing of seismic waves is by far the best way to study the interior of a solid world. It's because of the Apollo seismic experiment that we know the interior of the moon is cold, and that its crust is about 3 times thicker than Earth's at 60 kilometers thick. The experiment also told us that the upper 20 kilometers of the moon is heavily fractured from past huge impacts. Natural moonquakes were concentrated at about 1,000 kilometers depth and occurred repeatedly at the same sites at monthly intervals, indicating that it's tides from Earth's gravity that cause the moon's natural quakes. Got a question about the universe? Send it to us at planetaryradio@planetary.org. And now here's Matt with more Planetary Radio.
Back in the 21st century now for this week's edition of What's Up, which means Bruce Betts is at the other end of the Skype line. He's the director of projects for the Planetary Society. Welcome back. How's the sky?
Much clearer, but it depends on which way the smoke's blowing.
Had a lot of concern for you, especially in light of the trivia question that we're going to answer this week. A few people who said that they hope that your home never gets as hot as the surface of Venus, which was a possibility.
But it's all good. It's all good now. Well, you know, at least for my home.
So do tell us, what's up?
Venus, extremely bright in the pre-dawn east with dimmer reddish Mars above it. Mars getting higher, Venus starting to get lower, and coming up here in early October, very low in the pre-dawn east, you can check out also Mercury and Saturn, and they're all going to be clustering together between like October 8th and 13th. I'll give you a little more detail as that comes up, and then Saturn will be getting higher in the sky, Venus and Mercury going bye-bye. In the evening sky, still Jupiter, the thing to watch, extremely bright, low in the east in the early evening. On to this week in space history. This is how I now mark time, Matt, because I like to always let you know the anniversary week of when Lost in Space premiered on TV in 1965. Can't believe another year has passed.
You're absolutely right. That this has become a tradition for us. Dr. Smith, we salute you wherever you are.
Danger, 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 Matt Kaplan, danger.
I wanted to be Billy Mummy. I even got to tell Billy Mummy that once, that I wanted to be him really bad. He said, no, you really didn't want to be me.
That also explains the restraining order. I always wondered about that.
Yeah. Okay, you're telling all my secrets. Come on.
On to random space fact.
Oh, a tender ballad today.
Boom, boom. The space shuttle. Did you hear it the other day?
I sure did, and that's exactly what I heard. My God, I thought it went over again just now because you did that.
Well, I thought of recording it, but I knew that I could just recreate it so accurately. Yeah, space shuttle came and landed at its alternate landing site, Edwards Air Force Base. As you know, as I simulated, it has two distinct sonic booms that you hear when it goes flying over you, way over you. One from the leading part of the shuttle and one from the tail.
The booms seemed to be, there was more of a separation between them. I thought this time that's got to be subjective, right? Because I knew that that was the explanation, and it seemed like maybe the shuttle was going over at about 30 miles an hour.
Yes, it was this time, oddly enough.
That's good. I'm glad they've perfected that.
Bonus space fact for you to show that's probably not true. Its landing speed is about 220 miles per hour. And that whole, you know, boom has to be moving faster than the speed of sound. Unbelievable amount of energy, though. It amazes me that it can rattle windows all over Southern California when it comes in.
Yeah, had enough time to warn my wife to be ready for it so that she wouldn't think it was an earthquake.
Yes, I have done that before. But this time we were out there ready and listening. So on to the trivia contest. We asked you all, what's the ballpark surface temperature on Venus? How'd we do, Matt, other than those warm and tender feelings about my home?
Let me go right to the winner. We had a whole bunch of people who got it, and you did say ballpark, which is good, because there's a little bit of disagreement about this.
But also there's some variation with altitude on the surface and such, although a lot less variation than you get on Earth or any other planet.
Well, that only makes sense. Well, here's somebody who came in right in the middle of that, who got picked out by random.org as this week's winner. It's Suloni Shirka. Suloni Shirka of Toronto, Ontario, Canada, of course. 870 degrees Fahrenheit, are 465 degrees Celsius. So, Saloni, you get this week's Planetary Radio t-shirt and an OPT rewards card if you so choose. We did also hear from lots of other people who had interesting things to say, like William Stewart and several others who talked about the pressure down there at the surface, what would be sea level, I guess, 90-plus bar. He pointed out that most submarines would be crushed on the surface of Venus, which that does kind of make it real for you, doesn't it?
It does make it sink in. I hardly agree.
Lindsay Dawson said, yeah, you'd be cooked, corroded, crushed, and asphyxiated. But he figures that the big sport on Venus must be base jumping because the terminal velocity in that incredibly thick atmosphere is as low as 25 kilometers per hour. So what, maybe 15 miles per hour. Pretty cool. You don't even need a parachute.
It'll just melt anyway, probably.
So. Yeah, it'll just get eaten away or melt anyway. So just jump. all right.
And we have some excitement for this new contest.
We sure do. This is big stuff. Great prize, folks. And we're going to lead up to an even better prize.
Well, we are giving away season one on Blu-ray of the History Channel's series, The Universe. They are just starting, kicking off their fourth season. And they have some excellent experts on this fourth season, by the way.
Tell us about the special guest star on the episode that will air on the evening of September 22nd, Tuesday the 22nd at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific.
Well, as you might have guessed, I'm on it, as well as others, and we talk about 10 ways to destroy the Earth.
Which is good. Only 10. I'm glad you managed to limit yourself there. I will definitely tune in. And to mark that, I guess, the History Channel folks have given us some copies of previous seasons to give away.
Yeah, so you got this week we're giving away, again, the whole of season one on Blu-ray. There's all sorts of planetary episodes in season one, as well as a few more exotic ones, galaxies and E.T. and things like that.
And we're going to do the same next week, and then the week after that, we're going to give away the collector's edition of the Universe series. But go ahead and give us this contest that might win somebody those Blu-ray discs.
All right, to the nearest centimeter, how big is the universe? No. That's not it. But it seems more appropriate. But my question for you, to the nearest, not centimeter, to the nearest reasonable amount of distance, the Apollo Command Module astronauts have sometimes been called the most isolated humans ever because their closest other humans were on the moon. They were orbiting. How far away were they, roughly, when they were the farthest from any other human in the universe? Go to planetary.org/radio. Find out how to enter and earn your fascinating and enjoyable universe Blu-ray set.
And you've got until Monday, September 21 at 2 p.m. Pacific time, to go for this marvelous prize package, because we'll include a t-shirt as well.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about juggling. Thank you, and good night.
He's Bruce Betts, and he is quite the juggler. You got to see him in person sometime. He's the director of projects for the Planetary Society, and he joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California. Keep looking up.
I know what you're going through.
I've been there.
Nobody else I know has been there.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Not everyone understands that.
Things at home may be as you left them.
But you don't feel the same.
Join us at communityofveterans.org.
And connect to others who are going through the same thing.
Because no one knows what it's like to come back unless they were there.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
A leader in education in your community, Henry Ford Community College has provided excellence and innovation in education since 1938. We're proud to have launched the careers of thousands of students both in Michigan and around the world. Celebrate the 70th anniversary of Henry Ford Community College by becoming a student today. Achieve your dreams, and it starts with a visit to hfcc.edu or by calling 1-800-585-HFCC. Henry Ford Community College, your best choice, guaranteed.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're back live at the National Butt Out Finals. AJ Langer is all fired up. And there he goes!
It's out! He put his butt out in 2.6 seconds. Lori is with AJ. Lori?
AJ, how did you get your butt out so quick?
Well, I learned the hard way. I burnt the house down.
If you smoke, put it out. All the way. Every time. Smoking is the number one cause of preventable home fire deaths. Check out usfa.dhs.gov/smoking. A message from the U.S. Fire Administration and firefighters everywhere.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. We have a special show for you today all about our national parks. And award-winning filmmaker Ken Burns will talk with us about his new documentary series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. Journalist Joan Hamilton will also join us to talk about her recent article, Parks as Arcs, about how, in a warming world, national parks become labs where species learn how to survive. We're honored to be here now with filmmaker Ken Burns, whose new documentary series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea, premieres on PBS on September 27th. Welcome. It's great to have you here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with talking about the obvious question, why national parks and why now?
Well, I don't think I need to tell the members of the Sierra Club why, founded as they were by the great naturalist Prophet John Muir, who helped to remind all Americans of the glories of the natural world. This is the first time in human history land was set aside not for kings or noblemen or the very rich, but for everyone and for all time. It's an utterly democratic idea. In fact, it's the Declaration of Independence applied to the landscape. And we tend to think of the parks in a general sense as kind of a nature film or travelogues. And what we wanted to do is go back and resurrect the very complicated, conflict-filled history of how they came about. Human beings, and this is why the Sierra Club exists. Human beings are sort of naturally extractive and acquisitive, and some would even say rapacious. They look at a river and think dam. They look at a beautiful stand of trees and think bored feet. They look at a exquisite canyon and wonder what mineral wealth can be extracted. And what was so great about Muir and some of our forebears in the 19th century is that they were able to arrest that impulse and set aside some of these precious lands to give us a glimpse into a kind of wild primeval America before the Europeans tamed the continent. And we are, in some ways, we created a safety valve, a kind of place where we can go and restore ourselves, not just in a grand natural or geological sense, but now also because, like the idea of freedom that it mirrors, the idea of the national parks has also grown to include archaeological and historic and cultural and military sites, even places of shame. We've saved Manzanar, where Japanese-American citizens were interned. Central High School, still a working inner-city high school in Little Rock, Arkansas, where the crisis of desegregation in 1957 crystallized, is a unit of the National Park Service. So is Shanksville, PA, where United 93 went down, and Oklahoma City. We've been growing the idea of the national parks, and it was time, we felt, to go back and understand how utterly American they are and how utterly American and revealing of us the history of how they came into being are. And it isn't just a story of famous white guys. That is to say, it isn't just the story of Theodore Roosevelt or John D. Rockefeller Jr. It's a story that is black and brown and red and yellow and female and unknown, as well as the more familiar characters that populate anyone's general basic awareness of the national parks.
And of course, this Americana aspect of it is so similar to some of the themes of your other films, jazz, baseball, World War II. How is it similar or different to you from making those other films?
Well, I think it's very much in line with those. I'm sort of hesitant to call it Americana because that seems to slip into the sentimentality and nostalgia that often derails too many good films and too many histories. We're interested in a very complex story that engages a lot of themes. You know, for example, most people don't understand that the original impulse to save the national parks was spiritual. Later it evolved to the early conservation movement, of which Theodore Roosevelt was a shining star. Later it became sort of symbols of patriotism, as the first Park Service director in 1916, Stephen Mather, called them vast schoolrooms of Americanism. They thrived, paradoxically, during the Great Depression, and it's only later that they began to evolve and represent the complex ecological and environmental issues that we think of them as being bellwethers for today. So what we try to do is gather in a very complicated and very interesting American history that involves a lot of different people that when I got involved with this, I'd never heard of before.
Now, you mentioned the issue of diversity in the parks, and I'm wondering, if you were running things at the Sierra Club, how would you go about trying to make all Americans feel like they have a stake in the national parks and to show the parks as this a place for diversity and many different kinds of stories?
Well, I think I'd do what I've done, which is I'd spend 10 years working on a documentary film that would tell these dramatic stories and then go out into the communities and sort of say, hey, you know, there are many people who feel that pride of ownership, that know somewhere deep in their soul that they own part of the Grand Canyon, that this commonwealth that we have is so spectacular. But we also have to acknowledge that many Americans are oblivious to the parks and that there are many communities, often African American or Hispanic, that don't yet feel any ownership of the national parks. But we can go into those communities and have, over the last years, from inner city high schools to community groups to whatever you want to call it, making Spanish versions of our film, and show them heroes of the national parks that look and sound like them. And I want to say that this diversity angle is not some politically correct effort on our part. It is, in fact, a naturally occurring thing that is part of the story of the national parks. We didn't go looking for it. It's there. And so you'll meet Sons of Slaves, who helped create Biscayne Bay. You'll meet the African-American Buffalo Soldiers that were the first caretakers of Yosemite and Sequoia National Parks in the early part of the 20th century. You'll meet Native American, a Hispanic biologist, who really turned the Park Service away from the national parks as resorts and recreations where you feed the bears and kill the predators into a place where we preserve and reintroduce the predators and no longer feed the bears and understand that we are stewards of a very complex ecosystem that we are only a minor part of. Amazing characters that turn up again and again in this story that we were thrilled to get to know and equally more thrilled to share. And I think we're obligated to speak to all Americans and remind them of the glories which are theirs. And our whole outreach is based on this very simple notion that everyone within the sound of my voice, indeed every American, is a co-owner of the most spectacular seafront property, the most beautiful mountain ranges, the highest free-falling waterfall on the continent, the greatest collection of geysers on this planet, and the grandest canyon on Earth. And as co-owners, we ought to, every once in a while, go visit this property of ours, make sure it's been taken care of, because the last 8 years have been abysmal, and the backlog of maintenance work has climbed to more than $8 billion. Make sure it's taken care of, and then put it in our will for our posterity so it's around for our children's children.
Speaking of visit, do you have a favorite? Is that like asking someone to pick their favorite child? Is that an unfair question? I'm wondering if you can tell us your top five.
You know, it is a little bit like that because you fall in love with these places for all the different reasons. I just was a couple days ago hiking with my 4.5-year-old daughter to Delicate Arch, which for a 4.5-year-old is a pretty tough hike, and was one of the great payoffs of my life, and my heart soared at that. I love Yosemite. It was the first national park that we had visited on this production, and I thought the first I'd ever been to. I'd been to many Civil War battle sites when I was making my Civil War series in the 80s, but I thought this was the first natural national park I'd been to, and then I had a memory in the middle of the night at Yosemite when I should have been exhausted sleeping of a time in 1959 when I was 6 years old and my mother was dying of cancer and my household was demoralized and grim, as you can imagine, and my father was not a very good dad, suddenly just took me one weekend to Shenandoah National Park, a relatively small and modest park in the east, and I was suddenly able to reclaim memories over 40 years old that were dormant, that I could now have the sensation of his hand holding mine, just as I was holding the other day my young daughter's hand at Delicate Arch in Arches National Park in Utah. I can now remember what my dad's grip felt in 1959, 50 years ago, in Shenandoah National Park. And so I have Yosemite, one of my favorites. I'd say you got to go to Yosemite. You have to go to Yellowstone. You have to go to the Grand Canyon. The Utah parks, Zion and Bryce and Capitol Reef and Canyonlands and Arches are spectacular. Alaska has an array of parks that you could go there and spend 100 years and never know a fraction of them. Hawaii Volcanoes is the only place where new land is being created. created. You know, that island's getting a little bit bigger every day as the lava spews out, and that's a pretty wonderful phenomenon to see. And then some of the eastern parks, like the Everglades, where the diversity of the habitat and the environment are so inspiring. Plant life, the bromeliads and the orchids, the birds, the nighttime roosts of thousands of birds like ibises and herons and egrets and the wood stork, the only stork common to North America, and anhingas, the only place where alligators and crocodiles coexist. And it took a while even for the Park Service in the early part of the 20th century to realize that lacking waterfalls and mountain peaks and geysers going off, that this was this swamp, as so many people called it and wanted to drain, was in fact one paradise of a place. And thank God we were able to save at least a portion of it as one of the most diverse environments on our planet.
Now, obviously, a lot of people, as a result of seeing your documentary series, are going to want to see the parks, and they'll be inspired to visit them. So how do we balance making the parks accessible to everyone while trying to minimize human impacts on those lands?
This has been the central question from the very beginning. The paradox of the creation of the National Park Service is that they're for the benefit and enjoyment of the people. That's a good, noble impulse, very democratic, but they should be left unimpaired for future generations. But as you know, anytime you put a parking lot in or a road or whatever, you're beginning to affect that environment. And through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s, when attendance was soaring, it was very fashionable to lament that the parks were being loved to death, that anyone who'd sat in a traffic jam in Yellowstone could shake their head and wonder what to do. We created a lot of wilderness parks where there are no roads that require a much greater effort on the part of the visitors to get there and to spend some time there. And that's all been a good thing and an adaptive and continually enlarging idea. But, you know, as we've entered into this virtual world that so many of us, including our children, inhabit of cell phones and texting and video games and surfing the net and Facebook, attendance has leveled off and in some cases gone down. I'm pleased to say it's up this year. We actually think having more people than you know what to do with is a good problem to have in a democracy. If you just take one park, Zion, which used to have traffic jams and smog congestion in that beautiful, beautiful place that many people think is the most beautiful of all the national parks, they just finally said a number of years ago, you can't bring your car in. You're going to park here and you're going to take this bus. And there was a little bit of resistance, and now everybody agrees it's the greatest way to see Zion. So my hope from our documentary series is that every superintendent at every National Park Service site is angry at us because they don't know what to do with all the people, because then that forces a democracy to deal with those sorts of things, and that's a good problem to have in a democracy.
Absolutely.
If they don't have visitors, then they don't have people arguing to their congressman that there needs to be funding. If they don't have visitors, then you're not going to get that sense of connection to the country, the sense of kinship that your founder, John Muir, talked about, that when you go into these wild places, when you go into the mountains, he said, and get their good tidings, that you are able to participate in a kinship of all things, not just of other people, but of all things. And that, paradoxically, you feel your humility, but that makes you feel bigger. Just as the egotist in our midst is diminished by his or her self-regard, the national parks make us better people.
I'm just curious for your take on this one thing that I've been wondering about, which is, why do you think that President Obama's recent trip to the parks in August did not receive the same kind of media attention as his vacation on Martha's Vineyard or his trip to Hawaii? I was hoping it was going to create this huge buzz that would encourage lots of different people who had never been to the parks to go out and see them.
You know, we live in a media culture that thrives on conflict, and he's in the middle of trying to sell a health plan that has run up against enormous manufactured opposition by moneyed lobbyists. And I think that people always are willing to focus on the more controversial aspects of things rather than the things that are more durable. You know, if someone were to have come up with an elm tree utterly resistant to Dutch elm disease and a president planted 50 million of them so that in 75 years every town in America could be lined as they once were with elm trees, we would consider that a great accomplishment. But, you know, it doesn't bleed, so it doesn't lead on the nightly news. And I think sometimes we fall prey to that. There was some good coverage. Malia and Sasha became junior rangers, and there are lots of folks who follow their every action, and we hope that will inspire people. Just let's go back and talk about what the president was actually doing. He was going back to the places that his mother and his grandmother took him when he was a young boy, because they thought, living in Hawaii, that they wanted to connect him to the mainland and make him feel more American. And where did they take him in order to feel more American but to Yellowstone National Park and the grandest canyon on Earth? And that just speaks volumes. It's almost like that's why we made the film.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
No, this has been so great. We're so grateful that you would give us this opportunity to, you know, help us spread the word that on September 27th, PBS will begin broadcasting and running for six straight nights our six-part, 12-hour series on the history of our national parks.
Well, it's been really just wonderful having you on the show today, and I hope all of our listeners will tune in on September 27th for the premiere of the series on PBS, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. And for our listeners who are interested in hosting a house party, we are going to be giving away some free sneak peek DVDs of the highlights from the series. And we're going to be hosting house parties across the country for people who want to screen the sneak peek DVD with their friends on September 20th, a week before the series airs. So to find out more, just visit sierraclub.org/parks. Again, that's sierraclub.org/parks. Find out how you can sign up for your house party and get your free sneak peek DVD. Thanks again so much for being on the show. You've been listening to filmmaker Ken Burns, whose new documentary series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea, premieres on PBS September 27th. Joining us now in our studio is Joan Hamilton, the author of a recent article in Sierra Magazine called Parks as Arcs. The article explores how, in a warming world, our national parks become labs where species learn to survive. And she's here to talk with us about it today. Welcome.
Thanks, Early. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start by talking about what you mean by calling the National Park Service America's NOAA and the parks themselves the Ark.
Well, people are looking for ways to ensure that our plants and animals in this country and around the world are going to survive, weather the storm of climate change. And while the parks themselves, the national parks, are only 84 million acres out of 650 million acres of public lands in this country, they're very special places. They contain a good share of the species that live on this planet in our country. They have wonderful interpreters. They have people who can explain what's going on in nature to the public. And the public trusts the parks, loves the parks, has a close identification with parks. So while the acreage is small, parks are a place where climate change can be observed and explained, and the public can really get an appreciation of what it means for them and their fellow creatures on this planet. My hope is that the parks don't have to play Noah or God in this situation, that we will be wise enough to cut our emissions of CO2 and other greenhouse gases and to establish partnerships with land agencies to allow species to adapt and move. But there may be situations in which, say there's a rare orchid in the Everglades that will be inundated by sea level rise there, which could easily cover 60% of Everglades National Park by 2100. If that happens, then the Park Service has to make a difficult decision. They were founded on the principle of keeping things natural. That has been their mission all along. But in a time when things aren't natural, we've created climate change, people are responsible for this, maybe, just maybe, people have to take responsibility for what they've done and find a way for that rare orchid or for an endangered species to live somewhere else and perhaps move it there. Now, if you ask park people about that now, they feel very uncomfortable with it, but they know they have to consider it. They have to figure out whether they can do that in a way that wouldn't disrupt other ecosystems. So that's a key question that they're wrestling with right now. And from what I can tell, they're wrestling with it in a very thoughtful, responsible way.
In the article, you talk about helping certain at-risk species like the bull trout found in the lakes of Glacier National Park, helping them adapt to habitat changes that are wrought by climate change. So tell us a little bit more about that.
The bull trout it's actually not a trout. It's a char. It's related to trout, and it prefers the coldest water of any North American fish. So in a warming world, you have to worry a little bit about the bull trout. It's not only in Glacier National Park, it's in other more low-lying areas as well. And some species of some races of bull trout can survive in warmer waters. So the hope is that if we study the cold-loving bull trout and some of the warm-loving bull trout, there'll be a way for humans to help bull trout adapt or evolve in ways that will allow them to survive.
You wrote that that with the exception of Everglades National Park, which has developed this comprehensive plan to deal with climate change, most national park administrators are just now beginning to come up with these strategies. So do you think their efforts will prove to be too little too late, or do they still have a chance to avoid the worst effects of climate change on these species?
That's a very big question. And it's a question that I found park administrators and scientists were sincerely wrestling with all over the country. The reason Everglades is a little bit ahead of some of the other parks is that 10 years ago, Congress gave $10 billion to restore the Everglades. And the scientists there have discovered that the things you would do to restore the Everglades in normal times are very similar to what you would do to help species weather the storm of climate change. So they're ahead for that reason, and they have a very able administrator in Dan Kimball. Other parks are working as fast and as hard as they can to try to address the challenge. The man who's been selected by President Obama to head our Park Service, John Jarvis, has built a reputation within the Park Service as somebody who puts climate change first. So I find that very heartening. He was evaluating his employees in the Pacific West region on the basis of how much they were doing to address climate change during the Bush administration. He cares about this in a very deep way and understands it. He's a biologist. So I think if he's confirmed by the Senate, we'll have a very able leader in the Park Service.
Now, I think traditionally when we've talked about protecting parks, historically with the Sierra Club or other conservation groups, we've been talking about drawing a line on a map, you know, creating a boundary and protecting a certain amount of land. But as climate change affects habitat and species, that physical boundary for protection is no longer as relevant if the species need to migrate in order to have habitat that still works for them in our changing climate. So what does that mean for our parks, and what should we be thinking about in terms of developing protection plans for these endangered species?
That's very unsettling for people who've worked so hard to protect these parks. We've protected these 80-some million acres, and we're proud of it. But now we have to think beyond that. And people are moving in that direction. In the Sierra Club, climate change is one of the organization's top priorities. And within that program, there's a program called Resilient Habitats. And that's aimed at just what we're talking about, figuring out how to help these plants and animals. The same thing is happening at agencies across the nation. The Park Service is working with the Forest Service, is working with the Bureau of Land Management. Private landowners are helping out as well. So people, in a way, it's very exciting because scientists and land managers are working together across agency boundaries in ways that have never happened before.
Now, what, in your opinion, is the best or the most effective thing that people can do to preserve and help the national parks and the species that they shelter? I mean, does it help to visit the parks because you provide revenue? Or are there other ways people can make a difference on this?
I think one of the things that I found in doing my story, I thought I was going out to tell this very sad tale. I went out and I visited two parks in depth, and I found it was very inspiring to see those places. I live in a city. I got out and I saw those places, and I remember just how much we have left in this country. Tremendous riches. In Glacier National Park, you can get just a few steps beyond the Going to the Sun Highway, and you can see a mountain goat. You can see a bighorn sheep. You can walk half a mile out from Mini Glacier Lodge and see a grizzly bear or a black bear. It's incredible. And Everglades is the same way. There I sat at a pond at sunset. There was no one else there besides me and my husband. And in flew hundreds and hundreds of wading birds to nest on the trees across the pond. And pretty soon the sound of these birds just became deafening. It was white ibis, wood storks, roseate spoonbills. And I think based on those kinds of experiences that it's important for city people, people who live in suburbs, to get out to these places and remember what we have, what we've accomplished, how rich our biological heritage is. And I think once you've done that, you naturally spread those ideas to your friends and neighbors. And once you've done that, perhaps you go to an organization like the Sierra Club. Maybe you'll look at their website for national parks or resilient habitats, and you'll find ways to help out in a way that's comfortable for you.
Now, I know that you've brought some recordings with you of sounds from these parks, so tell us a little bit about what we're about to hear.
Well, I brought a recording of that night that I just described at dusk when I was sitting at Paroda's Pond. And I'd never heard anything like that. I felt like I was an explorer back in the 19th century when that came across.
Why don't we take a minute and listen to that right now?
This is Paroda's Pond, about 10 miles north of Florida Bay, right off the main road in Everglades National Park. It's a still evening at dusk. In front of us, there's an alligator swimming across the water. Behind the pond in the trees are hundreds of birds roosting. There are white ibis, little blue herons, roseate spoonbills, wood storks, anhingas, common egrets. Some of them are flying over our head to come into roost. There's fish jumping up and splashing. There's a big elegant egret tiptoeing through the water. Over on the distant shore, I can just see pink wings flapping, about three or four birds. It's definitely not a silent spring in the Everglades this year.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us today about your piece. You've been listening to Joan Hamilton, the author of a recent article in Sierra Magazine called Parks as Arcs. And you can read that article online at sierraclub.org/sierra. Again, that's sierraclub.org/sierra. If you're interested in learning more about our national parks, you can visit the Sierra Club's website at sierraclub.org/parks. Again, that's sierraclub.org/parks. You can also sign up to join and attend a house party to watch a special preview of Ken Burns' series. That's happening Sunday, September 20th in the evening at houses around the country. And you can find out more on the Sierra Club's website to see where a party is happening near you at sierraclub.org/parks.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
Hungry?
The Skylight Cafe is convenient and offers a variety of food options to hungry students and staff.
Pizza, daily specials, sandwiches, and entrees.
How about ordering something hot off the grill?
Or if you just want a snack.
The Skylight Cafe has cookies, desserts, chips, fresh fruit, and a wide variety of beverages.
There's even a soup and salad bar. Ours are
Monday through Thursday, 7:30 a.m. to 7 p.m. and
Friday, 7:30 a.m. to 2 p.m.
The Skylight Cafe.
Do you overcook your pasta? Do you mix your lights with your darks and tell long, complicated jokes that have no punchline? Do you have trouble wrapping gifts, sound like a hyena when singing happy birthday, and have no idea how the metric system works? Well, if you answered yes to any of the above questions, you may have what it takes to adopt a teen from foster care, because teens don't need perfection, they need you. So if you can't tie a Windsor knot, forget to defrost the chicken, can't tell a latte from a cappuccino, confuse North and South Dakota, overuse commas, throw a frisbee like it's a flounder, and still believe kids really do love lima beans, broccoli, and Brussels sprouts, it's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to put up with you. For more information on how you can adopt, call 1-888-200-4005 or go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
Local news and alternative views. That's the new WHFR Journal. Every
every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. on the station Making Waves. I'm your host, Jay Koronick, and along with other WHFR staff co-hosts, we'll talk about local issues and points of view not usually presented on other Detroit stations. So remember, check out the new WHFR Journal, Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m., or as a podcast from our website anytime, whfr.fm. We're really making waves.
WHFR, Dearborn.
89.3 WHFR.FM, the station making waves. It's Tuesday at 2 p.m., which can only mean one thing. Yes, that's right. You are listening to One Chord to Another. I'm your host, Jeff, and for the next 2 hours, I'll be playing a wide mix of indie rock and pop through the airwaves right into your preferred listening device. How cool is that? Let's get started this week with some local music. This is a band I've only had the opportunity to see live once, but I really enjoyed them. This is a great pop rock band out of Detroit, Ypsilanti, if I'm not mistaken, called Lightning Love. This is the song Girls Are Always Wrong on WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
Are always wrong. They find out later on. They find out later on when it's too late to fix what's done. Girls are always wrong. They find out later on. They find out later on when it's too late to fix what's done. When it's too late to fix what's done. When it's too
are always wrong. They find out on their own. They find out on their own. Then they're too ashamed to change what's done. Boys are always wrong. They find out on their own. They find out on their own. Then they're too ashamed to change what's done. And it's too
fail at everything, and every day's the same.